You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of January 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Barack Obama bids a somewhat fond farewell to the press.
It goes without saying that essential to that is a free press. That is part of how this place, this country, this grand experiment in self-government has to work.
But will his successor see things the same way? My guests Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Robert Fox will be discussing how the media should adapt to the oncoming Trump era and the day's other top stories, including Germany's increase in defense spending. But will it be enough to satisfy Trump and or impress Putin? The value of family in diplomacy and...
If Monsieur Hollande wants to administer punishment beatings to anybody who chooses to escape, rather in the manner of some sort of World War II movie, then I don't think that that is the way forward. And I think actually it's not in the interests of our friends and our partners.
Why the British still struggle to heed the most famous advice of Basil Fawlty in their interactions with their continental cousins. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Robert Fox, defence editor with the Evening Standard, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, reader in law at Birkbeck University, London. Welcome both. Barack Obama yesterday, of course, gave his last press conference as president, punctiliously thanking the attending hacks for their work during his term in office, almost certainly the last gratitude from the White House dais that the press corps can expect for at least the next 4 years. Obama also proffered a gentle reminder of the task now at hand. We need you, he said, to establish a baseline of facts and evidence that we can use as a starting point for the kind of reasoned and informed debates that ultimately lead to progress. Easy for him to say. Robert Fox, Obama's key words there, facts, evidence, reasoned, and informed. These are all very unfashionable ideas at the moment. How can the American media, especially the White House press corps, are going to have to try and deal with Trump day in, day out? How are they going to reintroduce those to the public discourse?
Well, can I first of all render Obama into Trump Twitter speak? Enough post-truth truthiness already, eh? That's what he was saying. With difficulty. Because Obama, as usual, when he's in good philosophical mode, he gets to the point, and it is a much, much bigger issue than it appears at the time. Because, as he would recognize through his adult life, the news business has been taken over by infotainment, and particularly in his country and in our country, and the one person who's primarily responsible for that, because he could have stopped or mitigated a lot, and it's Rupert Murdoch. But Trump is just a product of the infotainment world, that truth and media, for him, is part of an echo chamber. It's part of the exercise of political or global narcissus. You say what I like, and I'll tell you what I like. And I think that it's very clear what Obama was saying. Fact-driven journalism, news reporting, is very, very unfashionable indeed, because the people in the business, the accountants and the suits, as we call them, say it is very risky and very, very expensive. And the outgoing president is absolutely right. Look at the dreadful proposals that they're proposing in this country, where I'll have done 50 years in journalism come September. But the kind of restrictions and self-appointed vigilantes after the hacking scandal, have taken a license upon themselves, which actually no sensible government or no sense of anybody with a sense of public community should sanction at all. But it's a bad time and we've got to fight back.
Oscar, just building on what Robert said there, Donald Trump obviously is going to be a, for want of a more pejorative term, different kind of president. Does the media need to take a different approach? Will the the old model of he said, she said, a bit from column A, a bit from column A, maybe a bit of this, maybe a bit of that, will that model still do? Or do they now need to proceed from a baseline assumption that Trump is either lying or just making things up?
I would like to think that they would do the latter, but I have to agree with Robert and put my philosophical hat on in honor of the outgoing Obama. My problem with Obama's otherwise commendable call to the press is the assumption that somehow the press might be able to escape being imprisoned by its fascination with itself, this cinematic coup d'etat of the imaginary and the real, where banality and its celebratory status captures all in endless, vicious circles of spectacles of life and death. Lest we forget, it is precisely the reality TV show and its digital spawns, Facebook and Google Plus, which made possible the rise of Trump. And I do not believe that the press will escape that by denying the fact that this sea change has happened. So, as you said, Andrew, indeed, these notions of truth and factuality are old-fashioned. This is not to say that they are not needed. They are more needed now than ever. But we must begin by accepting that it is the truth, that the press is no longer the pillar of this democracy. And perhaps we need to be even more old-fashioned and consider the fact that old-fashioned self-organization of common people is historically proven to be the only resistance against fascism.
Robert, bringing to bear the 50 years in journalism you mentioned just there, what is a constructive response by the media to Donald Trump as president, assuming that what we know of him is what he's going to continue to be? What is a proper response when you have a person like Trump doing what he does? He throws a tantrum, he denies the premise of a story, he retreats into a parallel reality, he just throws up chaff. What's the way through that?
I'm taking up very much both what you and Oscar have said. Listen to his game, watch his game, but avoid all the time playing him at his own game, which I fear is what was going to happen right off.
And it's what has happened.
To date.
And Trump plays that game
exceptionally well.
That's the trouble. But there are people, there are columnists that you and I know who followed for years, like Maureen Dowd, who are playing him at his game of barely controlled hysteria. And this doesn't really work. I think it's a much bigger job than even we have been describing so far, because I think with a small e, it's a question of education. One of the things that has informed my journalism and has gone throughout, and I go backwards and forward, but my techniques and tactics of investigation and observation is history. Particular schools of history mean an awful lot. History is bad news in a lot of TV, radio, and a lot of newspaper coverage. More and more I read books, I'm a professional reviewer, of people who just do not know the stuff. I mean, these things happened. People were murdered here, and it's because we have all joined the commentariat. Reporting has got to come back to where it belongs, which is with the vulgus, the crowd, and on the street corner. It cannot be done from a screen just by editors looking at Wikipedia and so on. I go into the BBC to name guilty parties, and I see screen after screen with Wikipedia up. That ain't journalism. I think it's education in history, in civics, at quite a basic level, and also media studies. I have sneered at media studies, and I washed my mouth out and confessed I'd put sackcloth and ashes. It is very important that our young people are taught how to read Donald Duck, as the old thing was saying, because truthiness, this is the awful problem. Fantastic surveys done by the New York Times with young people in college and in schools. They don't know the difference between a planted article for advertorial advertisement and sponsored and factual reporting. go back to some of the greatest reporters of all time, and we are not a caste, we are not a priesthood, we are not a profession. People like Chekhov, the greatest piece of 19th century journalism was his journey to the island of Sakhalin, to the penal colony. A doctor who knew he was dying, a boy did the business. And also things like Autobiography of a Supertramp, which is the best reporting of middle America, I think, in the late 19th century by the hobo, bum, out-of-work Welsh poet W.H. Davis. These are the things that, you know, young people have to be encouraged to go back to because these people experienced it. Why I admire characters like those, they can say when they got it wrong. And we in the reporting media do not say nearly enough where we got it wrong. We've got a hell of a lot of things wrong, including Donald Trump.
Or Tolstoy or Gonzo journalism. Yeah. I mean, Robert just referenced that marvelous book by the Chilean playwright Ariel Dorfman, How to Read Donald Duck.
Yeah.
We need that kind of education back. We need to do away with the screenification of media and go back to reading good history books, not revisionist history, but good history books.
Well, on the hopeful thought that Donald Trump may prompt a revival of our trade, we will move on, because one of the more coherent gripes of the incoming president has been that a great many of the United States partners in NATO exhibit the tendencies of that pestilential freeloader who is known in their circle for being first out of the taxi and last to the bar. Member states are supposed to observe a defense spending target of 2% of GDP, but only five do: the US, the UK, Greece, Poland, and Estonia. Germany has now announced that it will boost its defence outlay, but still to only 37 billion euros, or 1.2% of its mighty output. Robert, does Donald Trump have a case here? Has Europe been coasting and expecting the United States to pick up their defence tab?
On that, he certainly does. They have lived off the back of the really superior power of America to do things. Again, it doesn't make particularly good copy. It's command and control, surveillance, really heavy lifting logistics, and also how you run really global intelligence operations in which they have only one trusted partner, and it must be said, primarily because of the GCHQ, General Communications Headquarters in Cheltenham, and it's the UK. The proof of the Trump pudding in this is, of course, the ghastly mess. From every point of view, when Europe tried to lead its own NATO operations in Libya in 2011, they could not do it. They had to call in the States. And the aims were wrong, the tactics were wrong, the equipping was wrong, and they just could not do it. But I'm even more skeptical. I think even the British beating 2%, I don't particularly like figures, but actually it's a complete fudge. It's about 1.6%. Let me tell you very quickly how the British do it. They put in pensions and allowances and depreciation and GCHQ that I mentioned, the building, and so on. Come on, weasel words, chum. But I don't care about that. And this is where I question Trump. What do you want NATO for? Don't look over your shoulder. Don't look back to the foundation and the Soviet Union, the Warsaw Pact, and so on. What does security, collective defence mean in the mid-21st century? It means a lot more things than we have heard from any of the NATO leaders recently. I mean, the huge impact on instability and movement of climate change, for example, barely crosses their radar screens.
Oscar, persisting with the theme of asking Midori House guests, does Donald Trump have a point? is NATO obsolete, as he recently seemed to suggest?
Just to follow up, I don't think Donald Trump has a point, because he's a sort of triangular person. He moves from here to there to there. So you, that may be a tactic. So you never really know what he's going to do. So you're never in a real position to criticize him. But on this point, at least we know two things. You know, he denies climate change. He doesn't really think that NATO works as far as he's concerned. And he doesn't think so because, you know, he has the psyche of the kind of person who thinks he can only, you know, the good job can only be done if he does it. He's not a team worker, which is why he's going to try and come up with this sort of bilateral "I love you, you love me," you know, the Putin thing, running foreign relations, and that's absolutely crazy, and is going to lead to very probably the next war. He, of course, it is the case that NATO allies should be trying to reach their expenditure. I think it's very interesting to see Greece, poor Greece, being one country that actually does it.
Always has done so.
It always has done so. Actually, I phoned a friend of mine who's a member of the Greek Parliament and he's dealing with these matters, and he told me, well, we have always done so, because this is, in their minds, this is the tradition of precisely being a bulwark against fascism. And that is a point.
Robert, to come back to where we came in, which was this increase in German defence expenditure, has the accession of Donald Trump and, I guess, the departure of the UK from the EU, if not NATO, has it made Germany more important in terms of Europe's security?
Oh, absolutely vital. The problem is we're getting into a much bigger area now. But with all the hand-wringing of Mrs. May and her speech about Brexit is Brexit, and it does look as if it's a hard quit out of the single market and out of the customs union, it is going to be a Reich.
She hasn't said anything about the defense implications.
Nobody is talking about it, but Merkel has been. The problem is that this allows the EU to go on its convergent line, the ever closer union. And as almost a namesake of yours, Andrew, Jan Werner Müller, has pointed out,
no relation.
It operates on the basis of being a conclave. And people like Renzi of Italy, curiously, who's the most outspoken on this, says, yes, we must get together and get together. If it is going to be a hegemony, whatever Hollande, whatever Renzi says, whatever their successors say, it will be run by Germany, because at the centre of it will be the Bundesbank. And I think that that's where, as you say, the UK, in a way that this UK government certainly doesn't realise, is in a very, very peculiar position of isolation indeed.
OK, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Müller, Robert Fox, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Coming up next, when the personal overrides the political.
A new year is upon us and a fresh issue of Monocle is hitting the newsstand. Eager to start the year as we mean to go on, we've packed the February issue full of ideas for how to make our cities and our lives healthier, smoother and, well, just better. In our 100th issue, we take a whistle-stop tour of three cities designed for healthy living, offer up some lessons, courtesy of a group of Dutch nuns, on how to learn a new foreign language, and we discover the smartest methods out there for making cities safer. The February issue of Monocle will have you shaking off any final vestiges of holiday slumber and sprinting into 2017 well-informed and suitably inspired. Monocle's February issue. Buy your copy today. Happy reading.
And you are back with Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Robert Fox and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Now, one diplomatic rapprochement that President Obama has been unable to engineer during his time is between the United States and Bolivia. The two countries have not exchanged ambassadors during his time in office. However, according at least to Bolivian media, Obama did speak to his Bolivian counterpart, the chunky-jumpered populist Evo Morales, last year. The topic, the presence on an educational expedition to Bolivia by the president's eldest daughter, Malia Obama. Oscar, does this sound plausible to you? I mean, obviously, Morales and Obama have not got on terrifically well during their respective terms. Is it possible that both men would be able to set that aside to discuss the safety of Malia Obama as she visits?
Oh, it's very plausible. At the very least, it's absolutely certain that U.S. diplomats would have contacted the Bolivian government to guarantee the security and discretion surrounding Malia's visit. But what impresses me about this story is something a bit different. The idea of Obama's eldest daughter escaping from the Washington bubble out into the reality of a country that has been struggling to pursue its own destiny, following a political path that is very much unlike the one that her father followed. I find that very interesting. You know, the coming of age of this young girl is, in a sense, or might be read as a sort of Freudian killing the father story.
Possibly. Alternatively, perhaps she just fancied going to Bolivia.
Perhaps it's just wishful thinking and she had a great time.
I mean, Robert, can things like this make a difference, though, in like actual nation-state diplomacy, a perhaps even random personal connection between two global leaders?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does because a thing that we haven't factored in, and you're not going to get it in Trump land for obvious reasons, nor in Hillary land, I fear to conjecture, it's the sheer dignity of the Obamas. Malia went on this because I'd love to have gone on it. It was a cultural tour in the deepest sense so that she could exploit and exchange, and she stayed in villages, and she went with a group, and they've got a quote from somebody who escorted them, and they were told a very important young person was coming in a group of four or five. And there were Malia and her friends, and one was a very striking blonde, apparently. It's a lovely story, this. So the escorts thought she was the very important person, inevitably.
Speaks volumes about Latin American race.
And apparently she went over very well because she was quiet, she did all the cooking, and her Spanish was the best of the group, too. It does make an enormous lot. And I'm just thinking of Dreams of My Fathers and Obama's writing, look, Barack, it ain't all over for you yet. There's a job out there because he's a natural-born writer and communicator. And if he's telling us to keep going, he's got to keep going too. I do think this is terribly important. I do know childhood friendships that were formed, but don't bank too much on it. We've been talking about Cyprus, haven't we, in the news recently. It was always assumed after the occupation and after the terrible business of 1974, 20, 30 years in, when two school chums, Ralf Denktash and Glathglos Klerides, were both heads of the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus and of Cyprus, they had sat next to each other in class. They were friends. I mean, they went to the funeral of the Denktash son. But it got absolutely nowhere.
Well, in contrast, the good news of 2016, the peace agreement in Colombia, the almost two decades that a member of the government and now in charge of the post-conflict process and a member of the guerrillas spent together actually made the process much easier and possible. They develop a very uncanny friendship in the process and that went over their political differences. But I just wanted to say that, given that these are darkest, really dark times, it is a really good idea to place our hope in the possibility of this young Obama girl, becoming, inverted commas, radicalized in Bolivia. At the very back to America. Yeah,
we're going back to our roots, aren't we there?
Going back to America under Trump and kickstarting something.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, on that hopeful note, finally tonight we shall move along. And there is good reason, I think, why the key refrain of the sixth episode of Fawlty Towers remains 40 plus years after its first utterance, probably the most cherished catchphrase in British comedy history. In this week's interactions with the EU they seek to abandon, senior British politicians have once again been unable to refrain from mentioning the war. Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson warned French President Francois Hollande against administering punishment beatings to escapees in the manner of some World War II movie, and Brexit Secretary David Davis declared that if Britain could cope with World War II, it could cope with Brexit, despite the two things being obviously not remotely comparable. Robert, where does, this is where I'm asking you to speak on behalf of your entire people, where does this come from? Why can Britain, or at least a certain cohort of British society, not let this go? Because this is not helping, is it? In that context, as Britain is trying to leave the EU, going to Europe and banging on and on and on about the war, it's not going to help, is it?
I'm terribly sorry to say, from a very vulgar point of view, for comedy script writers and tabloid headline writers, the Second World War, particularly for the Brits, where they weren't particularly good, is a gift that keeps on giving.
Indeed.
There have been very funny things written about it. Boris, he's a bit bonkers, maybe. He's a friend of mine, Boris Johnson. I don't agree with him ideologically, but he is a very funny man. And he's a sort of joke machine. And these things come out. And actually, for a certain one of us, because it wasn't malicious, this, at all. It is
it
quite...
It may not have been intended as malicious,
it,
but...
It was quite funny. But the audience to which he gave it, I have a Dutch wife, it's absolutely terrible. Yeah. It's completely wrong. And this keeps on happening. And we have
a
great saint in paradise now, in the pantheons of English literature, who got it wrong about the Second World War during the Second World War, and that was P.G. Woodhouse. who took his captivity by the Germans very lightly and did some very funny broadcasts. Unfortunately, he did it for them and not for the.
Oscar, how does this recurring habit look to you? I mean, I as an Australian, I kind of get it because we have an overlap of history and I guess cultural sensibilities with the British, a very, very close one. But from, I guess, even further away from Britain than Australia, how peculiar does it seem to you?
Well, as both a Latin American and a Londoner, it looks to me as a way to escape back, sort of nostalgia, to escape back to a time when Britain fought the good fight.
And just about made it.
But that reveals a consciousness on characters like Boris Johnson that this is not a good fight, that this is not a good cause. These people do not believe in what they are doing. This is the problem. Actually, you get it when you ask, what's the movie he's referring to? And it is...
it's The Great Escape,
exactly,
presumably.
Yeah. It is The Great Escape. If that is the case, then Brexit is being conceived of as a great escape, a retreat behind walls. And this momentous shift in which the border ceases to be a possibility and becomes a peril is a very
I think Boris Johnson does rather see himself as Steve McQueen on the motorcycle.
Well,
at least before he ends up entangled in the barbed wire.
Can I just say,
he couldn't wear a leather jacket even if he tried.
I hadn't thought of it because, Oscar, I have to say, and Andrew and listeners, following this through, as I said, having a Dutch wife, spending an awful lot of time in Italy, the idea that they couldn't make this work, that they couldn't, as the Neapolitans would say, latte d'arrangiarsi, of organising the thing, I cannot get over from Farage through to Mrs. May and her troika of Boris Johnson, David Davis and Liam Fox. Why are they so shrill? Why are they so hysterical about it? Because it's a damn bad cause.
Yes, they know
that's it, amongst other things. And this is a kind of displacement. We were just mentioning, we'll mention it again, that on the common foreign and security policy where Britain really should have a buy-in, and it's a very important part of the EU and the EU bridge with NATO, and Britain has to be in there. It's still a NATO partner. This is not being discussed.
It's really strange.
At
that's
all,
very strange.
At all. And yet, this
would be a very good bargain chip. And they're not using
it. Is obsessed with terrorism, and she thinks terrorism is intimately hip and thigh linked to migration, a thing which is far too simplistic in my estimation. Yet she hasn't brought this up at all. Yeah, it is. Unfortunately, again, a great comedy series. We've had Little Britain, but the little Englandism that is coming out of this. And this is why people like Boris, I'm sorry, he is a clever and a funny man, but he comes over as a complete caricature.
Absolutely, because he's displaying cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
He knows
he
doesn't believe in what he's doing. Yeah. The government does not believe him, but they're trying to persuade us. I mean,
do you think it's almost comical. Do you think this is why, as well, that they're still trying to portray Brexit not as this xenophobic pull up the drawbridge retreat, but they're trying to sell the idea that no, it's actually the gesture of a long repressed internationalist sensibility?
Come on, they use the sort of liberationist language that you would expect from a Latin American 1970s guerrilla fighter. Yeah. Really awkward to me to listen to bodies using the language of, you know, liberation and independence from the European Court of Justice. I mean, what is that all about? The hysterical mode of these characters reveals that they do not believe in what they're doing.
Can I say, I think there's another thing, though. I think they're scared because the train has left. The train has left the station.
Look,
I mean, they've invoked Article 50, it's done. But it was done a long time ago, and I think the swing figure, I don't think he was the architect of it necessarily, just drifted along with it, was Cameron. And once Cameron started the whole process, it was gone.
It was gone. To quote Friedrich Nietzsche, they have been staring at the abyss too long, now the abyss is staring back at them.
And on that happy thought, Robert Fox and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, thank you both so much for joining us. That is all for today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, research by Fernando Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alexis Sogol. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next at 1900. Tom Edwards is in with The Urbanist, and there's more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.